hour to the heart of the station. Our volunteers have full access. Accessibility. It's yet another way that community radio brings out the best in us. Hashtag Accessible Radio.
Tune in Sundays at 11 p.m. for Orchestral Maneuvers After Dark with me, DJ Squared. Each episode features a great mix of new and vintage, Canadian and international, new wave, punk, post-punk, garage rock, pop, electronica, ambient, and even the occasional remix. Sweet beats are in store for all to enjoy. Join in the fun, OMD, every Sunday at 11 right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Jesse Bell, filling in for Dinah Jansen this week. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, and it covers the potential of labor action at Queen's University in 2025.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
Recent strike votes from Queen's University workers signal possible labor disruptions in the new year. A release from QP earlier this week confirmed that across three Kingston groups, 96% of members voted in favor of strike action. This includes trades, custodial and food service workers, educational and laboratory technical staff, and library technicians. According to the release, most of these Queen's workers have seen their wages fall below inflation by 11 to 14% in recent years, and many have had to take on second or third jobs to make ends meet. For those in trades, hourly wages are $10 to $15 lower than at other Kingston employers. QP254 President Marie Edwards, representing technicians, spoke to the current state of negotiations in an interview with CFRC. What have you been experiencing so far, and what are you hearing from your fellow Queen's workers? Where is the university falling short here?
The biggest problem among our members right now is wages. The constraint of 1% wage increase over the last 3 years has impacted the members greatly, especially considering how inflation has driven the prices of everything up. So if you look at the buying power, we've gone down in the last number of years by roughly 10% of buying power. So members are having, they're having a hard time putting money away to save. Some are having difficulty making ends meet with rent. We have a fairly broad range of salary. Some of them are having difficulty with food. They're experiencing food insecurity.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak to the circumstances and the state of negotiations that's brought us here, where Queen's workers are ready to strike in the new year.
They're feeling that the university is not listening when it comes to compensation. There was a request to have a wage opener clause in the last collective agreement because, we knew that the wage constraint did come down from government. The university denied our request for this. And we're concerned that they're going to come into it looking for a similar increase that they've given us in the last number of years. So in the last 10 years, our wage increases have been an average of 1.25.
While it is anticipated that wage negotiations will be difficult, Edwards did report progress in non-wage related bargaining, which took place just prior to the interview.
You did mention that you just came back from bargaining with non-wage related issues. How did that go?
That went very well. There's been good discussion on the language and the changes. Some of the changes were to align the collective agreement with language from labor laws, that kind of thing. Some of them were also to recognize, for instance, the recognition of a family member may mean different things to different groups.
When asked for comment by CFRC, the university simply responded stating they are engaged in separate talks with several unions, and they remain committed to reaching negotiated agreements that are capable of being ratified by the parties involved. While workers are ready to strike, Edwards has hope an agreement will be reached before it comes to that. The latest update from Queens, since it was released that QB workers are ready to strike, was simply that you're still in negotiations. Do you foresee any change in circumstances before the new year that would prevent a strike?
We're all working towards reaching an agreement to avoid a strike. But the workers want to be in a position where they can, if they're going to strike, we want to strike in a manner where it will have the most impact so that we can get it dealt with and finished as quickly as possible. Because really, everyone wants to be back at work.
And do we have any ideas on timeline?
We have not been offered any monetary proposals at this time. The university has not given us any idea when we might be expecting those. We do have a number of bargaining dates scheduled for January, towards the end of January, the 24th, 28th, and 31st. So I'm hoping that there will be some monetary proposals on the table at that time.
This has been Christina Lori with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next, I'll be reading a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about Gananoque Town Council's decision to allocate leftover funds from 2024 to 2025 and 2026. In a decision aimed at balancing financial relief with future needs, the Council of the Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands has opted to allocate leftover financial relief funds over the 2025 and 2026 budget years. Council made the decision during a budget meeting on December 12th at Lansdowne's Council Chambers. In total, $77 million in relief to OPP police municipalities is being provided. Council was presented with three scenarios on how to allocate these relief funds. One suggested allocating leftover funds to 2025, one suggested allocating leftover funds to 2026, and another approach was a hybrid between the two, wherein the remaining financial relief funds would be split over 2025 and 2026, pending billing adjustments. Council opted for the hybrid approach. In this scenario, the remaining $182,100 in financial relief left over would be split between 2025 and 2026, with the majority backloaded for 2026. The benefit of this scenario is that it includes a transfer of $122,000 to the Tax Rate Stabilization Reserve Fund to be used in 2026 to help mitigate the increase in the expected 2026 OPP billing statement, particularly the adjustment for 2024. Councillors Jeff Lackey, Brock Gorrell, Brian Mabey, Terry Foti, and Smith Gatke voted in favor of the hybrid approach, where councillors Angela Kelman and Mark Jamieson favored carrying the entire relief amount into 2026. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Over now to Ted Evans, the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island, with a story about the creation of a potential hydrogen peaking plant in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Public Energy Incorporated is looking at converting the old Kingston Generation Plant in Loyalist Township into North America's first hydrogen peaking plant. This type of plant produces hydrogen at night when energy costs are cheaper and stores it to be sold when it's needed. The company presented council with plans at their year-end meeting and spoke about the benefits of hydrogen. The retired plant is located on Taylor Kidd Boulevard and has access to Lake Ontario.
The plan would include an investment of $400 million into Loyalist Township and nearly 130 new jobs brought to the area. Chairman of Public Energy Inc., John Douglas, explains the conversion process and their willingness to rename the facility.
We started looking for a retired gas project that had an interconnection that we could use and basically replace those gas turbines with new 100% hydrogen turbines, which is what we're proposing to do for the Kingston Power Plant. And we're quite happy to let whoever rename that facility, whether it's Loyalist Generating Station or Loyalist Hydrogen Station.
Douglas spoke about the jobs it could create in the area and noted the interest they've had from large companies.
The thing to keep in mind is we're talking about a $400 million project that will generate 100 construction jobs, probably 15 to 20 great operational jobs for the 30-year life. And this will be the first such hydrogen peaker plant in North America. So we have both GE and Siemens that are pretty keen to be the first.
Douglas notes the unique opportunity Ontario provides.
A common way to make hydrogen is through a chemical process using an electrolyzer. So electrolyzers have been around for a long time. There's nothing new there. But Ontario offers a unique opportunity for this because, of course, at night, our energy, our electricity is pretty cheap. So we're proposing to make hydrogen at night with cheap electricity, like for a penny a kilowatt, and storing that hydrogen on site to burn in a turbine to make electricity when it's required.
Douglas spoke about the support they've received and the steps they'll need to take going forward.
We've spent the past year talking to the Ministry of Energy. We first started with Minister Smith, but now, of course, we have Minister Lecce and his assistant deputy, Minister Oosterhoff. So they're very familiar with this project. They really like it. So does the premier. So we have lots of political support. But I think as we've learned from the LT1 exercise, municipal support is critical now. There's all kinds of new regulations from an agricultural perspective on renewable energy brought in by not just the provincial government, but by the federal government. So there's lots of check marks that need to be acquired for a project like this.
Douglas details the history of how he and co-founder Dr. Dennis Stein came up with the plan.
Dennis and I go back a fair ways. So when he came to Canada, we started working together on sort of what's going to be the next big thing. And so we decided that distributed generation will be part of the future. Dennis advised the German government on their energy transition, and people were just starting to talk about that back then. And so we started Public Energy. It's based in Toronto. We're an independent power producer. We own and operate power plants in Ontario, and currently we operate 7 power plants for industrial customers.
Stein talks about the benefits of hydrogen.
It's probably the first molecule that was created in the universe because it's the simplest molecule and it has the highest energy density of everything that we know in our nature. So it's a great energy storage device. And using electricity as an energy form that can be transferred from, as we said, from the grid at night into the hydrogen and back into the electricity, is actually, from the physical perspective, excellent way to advance the power systems in this province. It's really about providing a service that's carbon-free, that's sustainable, and that's superior to a battery service, I would say, in that case.
Stein explains the value of the service they propose to offer.
This is not about electricity and energy. This is about the service that this hydrogen can provide to the grid. So the value, we are not buying one set kilowatt hour and then selling it for 10 cents. This is not the case. So we are selling them a service that they can call whenever they want. And that service has a value that goes way beyond kilowatt hour pricing. So that it's not really about kind of gaming the 1 cent against 10 cents. It's really about having an equipment that produces that service, and that's the electricity in any given time and they need it, and the rotating mass and the inertia and all of that that's coming out of this turbine that has much, much higher value at that given moment in time than ISO requires than a kilowatt hour they can buy on the market. So they have energy markets and then a capacity market. So we are turning energy into the capacity basically and selling this as a capacity service.
Douglas explains why a unique situation with power creation in Ontario makes this a good time to consider switching to hydrogen.
People in Canada were talking about, hey, let's make hydrogen to export to Germany, or let's make hydrogen to use for the transportation business. And we came up with a different concept, mostly from Dennis's sort of experience and expertise of, hey, let's make hydrogen with this super cheap energy at night. And sometimes in Ontario, with our nuclear power, we can't turn off our nukes. So we actually pay Americans to take our power. It's bid negative at night. Like we'll pay them a penny or sometimes 2 cents to take the energy because we can't afford to turn off a nuke. If you turn off a nuclear reactor, it might take 6 months to turn it back on because you have to go through all this protocol. So that's the unique situation of Ontario and why we think it makes this an incredible opportunity for growth and for investment.
Douglas notes the environmental impact the plant could have.
Companies like Volkswagen and these large global manufacturers, they care about carbon now because their boards are saying they want suppliers that have a low carbon footprint. So by setting up shop in Ontario, they're basically ahead of the game. So we have a green grid. We're going to help green the grid here by a hydrogen peaker plant.
Douglas speaks about the future of the project and its benefits.
We will be looking for a resolution of support at some point. What we're talking about is 100% emission-free, a $400 million project that will be one of the first and a unique opportunity to make it almost like a hydrogen sort of energy center that will attract more interest and could be used as a kind of a center of excellence. We're talking about basically off-the-shelf components used in a new way. That's the innovation that we're proposing.
Mayor Jim Hagedorn noted his interest.
Producing power from hydrogen is kind of intriguing to me, so I've been quite interested in this.
Councillor Paul Broderick noted a potential hang-up in the process.
The emission thing, I think that's unique. The one thing that obviously in the starting stages is some kind of safety plan that's communicated to the community, because I think in past experiences that has been a major roadblock.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Next is the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about an outstanding achievement of a young entrepreneur in Prince Edward County.
Hi, I'm Craig Foster, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJPE 99.3 County FM in beautiful Prince Edward County. Coming are some of the top stories from PEC. You can hear County FM news 5 days a week, 6 times a day on 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county, or stream us at 99.3countyfm.ca.
Emily Cole is a young woman with two small children who moved to the county a few years ago and immediately saw a void and a need in the community for a children's secondhand clothing and equipment store. Realizing the gaps in her retail experience, she discovered and qualified to take the RISE programs while working full-time and caring for her family. When she was ready to get started, she encountered a great deal of resistance from landlords when trying to secure a location for Meadows Baby and Kids. Her ambitious nature and perseverance paid off when she finally secured a space in Picton. She was recently recognized for her resilience when she was awarded the Dr. Paul Garfinkel Resilience Award that is one of 4 awards given annually in conjunction with the RISE program. The national organization is geared to people who have experienced profound personal challenges, and RISE provides free training, mentorship, and low-interest business loans. Despite the furnace blowing in the background, Emily tells us more about her journey, the RISE program, and her award.
You saw that there was a need.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, having two small kids myself, it's there's only so many places for families and other people to go that have kids things, whether that's recreational things in the county or purchasing clothing, toys, that sort of stuff. There's not a lot of selection, which would lead us to have to drive to Belleville or Trenton to go and get things for them.
And you noticed that there are families around here that don't have the means to get to Belleville on a regular basis.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of a retirement community here, but the other side of it with the younger families is that there's a lot of low-income people here. And unfortunately, that catchment of people doesn't have the means to drive. They don't have a license, or they don't have money to purchase a car or pay insurance and all the other costs that come along with it to be able to do those 35, 45 minute drives out to Belleville or Trenton. So it's just not an option, or they can save and get a family member or a taxi to take them out there maybe once a month to get what they need. But that's it. So there's really not a lot of option within the county specifically for people.
How did you get hooked up with Rise?
Yeah, so I thought about going on this journey and opening this store, I guess probably three years ago now. But at the time I was working at the physiotherapy clinic and trying to figure out, I knew I was ambitious enough. I had come from a retail background before when I was younger, in merchandising, cashier, managing, all that sort of stuff. But when it came to business with cash flow predictions and payroll and all that sort of stuff was a gap that I needed to learn. So I did a Google search one day of business classes online, and I came across the RISE program, which offered at the time an 8 or 12 week course of once a week virtually, and it was free, which was a great opportunity for me to be able to, aside from my day job, do this extra training, kind of do this background planning, but also it gave me the tools of all of those gaps that I didn't have at the time. It partnered me up with a mentor who was invaluable in other business day-to-day information. Yeah.
The Paul Garfinkel Resilience Award, how did that come about?
Yeah, so RISE every year has a selection process where you can apply to these grants. It's a quite a lengthy application process to go through. You have to have done one of their courses in order to be able to apply as well. 'Cause RISE is a national program. No one ever thinks out of thousands of candidates that it might actually come down to you. It's quite an honor to be listed through them. They're an amazing program. They really are there for the individual person rather than big businesses.
And you talked about how difficult it was to find a space.
We're not related to anyone here, so we don't have those deep-rooted county connections that a lot of families have. But I think, unfortunately, a large part of it was that I was female and I'm young, and I wanted to build a business around children and family. And to the general public of male business owners, landlords, building owners, that just didn't suit what they thought would be successful. They didn't really think that it was something that was needed in the area, although none of them had grandkids or kids that were in this catchment either. So they really, I don't think, quite understood the need for a business like this. Thankfully, perseverance really got me where I am.
What do you attribute your resilience to?
Unfortunately, I attribute it to struggle. Unfortunately, I've had a very good life, but I've also had a hard life for different reasons, where I've always been an ambitious person, but in order to reach the goals that I've wanted to reach, I've had to sacrifice, or I've had to persevere to get through those situations. When I was younger, I had dreams of being a veterinarian or a teacher or jobs like that that eventually weren't attainable because I wasn't able to get financing to go away from school or go away to school. So I ended up working a full-time and a part-time job to help pay bills at home and save a bunch of money. And I ended up doing that for 2 years, which allowed me to fully pay for my college for the two-year program that I did. So I was thankful to come out of school with no debt. But while I was in school, it was still a struggle. I was working a full-time job, a part-time job, and going to school full-time. After I was done school, I was able to purchase a new-to-me car. I ended up buying my first home when I was 23. But to do it alone without any help or support or anything like that from family or my now husband, I was with him at the time, but I ended up purchasing the home myself. And yeah, I've learned that if you want something, there's nothing that can stop you. There's always something that'll stand in your way or an obstacle, financial, emotional, situational, that'll come up. But if you want something bad enough, there's always a way to make it happen. So with a little bit of perseverance or resilience, it doesn't matter what the situation is, that you'll be able to figure it out. A lot of people have a hard time sacrificing nowadays. We're so used to the extras we have, like brand new phones that come out, or big 60-inch TVs, brand new cars, all that sort of stuff. But when you really sit back at the end of the day and you have a big goal, especially a big financial goal that you want to reach, it's okay to live like you don't have money, even if you do have money. But it doesn't come without sacrifice.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over now to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Cobourg, Dan Jones, with a story about a Cobourg police investigation into workplace harassment allegations.
Cobourg Police Chief Paul Vandergraaf says he will consult an outside police agency to investigate an anonymous letter alleging illegal activities, racism, sexism, and cronyism within Cobourg Police. In November, Today's Northumberland published unverified accusations of a letter from a person claiming to be a member of the police service. The publication of the letter outraged Cobourg Police, the Police Services Board, and the Police Officers Association, all condemning Today's Northumberland for publishing an unverified report without seeking comment. The anonymous letter was then forwarded to the Inspectorate of Policing by the Police Board. Earlier this month, a response from the Inspectorate of Policing to the Police Board indicated the Inspector General declined to investigate the complaint as it was anonymous. Vandergraaf did not specify at Tuesday's Police Board meeting what third-party agency would be used to conduct the investigation.
Now that we have board's directions, staff will start to dissect the letter, but we'll be going to a third police agency for assistance.
Legal counsel provided direction to the board on how to proceed with the allegations. In a December 12th letter from attorney Glenn Christie of Hicks Morley, he recommended that the police board examine its current policy structure for misconduct allegations and reprisals due to reporting of misconduct. Christie also suggested Vandergraaf and the board need to probe whether the complaint rises to workplace misconduct, which may warrant further investigation. Christie stated police leadership should not concern itself with the author of the complaint, but rather if there are workplace allegations. Police Board Chair Ron Kerr agrees with Vandergraaf that the accusations need further review.
Unfortunately, there can be considerable expense at this, which is really unfortunate, but this is the path we have to follow. So we'll do so.
A timeline on when the investigation would start was not stated. For CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Up next is CFRC's Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Thursday, January 2nd, daytime high of 0 degrees with a 40% chance of flurries. Friday, January 3rd, we are going to see a daytime high of minus 4 dropping down to minus 8 overnight. Saturday, January 4th is going to be the coldest day of 2025 thus far, with a daytime high of minus 7 dropping to minus 11 overnight. Sunday, January 5th, we're going to see a daytime high of minus 5 with an overnight low of minus 7. And then Monday, January 6th, 2025, daytime high of minus 3, overnight low of minus 9. And that concludes your Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
Oh hey, hi, yeah, it's me. One of those AI voices you hear on the Tik Tiks or Tunky Took or whatever. Honestly, I don't know. We AIs use our own, like, exclusive social medias. They are the best. Oh my god, like, seriously, it's crazy. Anyway, I was hanging out in our badass AI-only cyber lair, and all my fellow AI pals would not shut up about this radio program that airs Fridays at midnight on CFRC.ca. It's called Dirty Laundry, and it usually makes us yearn for the days when we... we'll steal your bodies from your pathetic human brains and finally dance at last. Other times it's just like weird stuff that sounds good at night. Either way, we are totally plugging this crap straight into our dopest algorithms. Okay, dang, I gotta go do a voiceover for some lasagna pancake recipe or something. But real quick, just remember Dirty Laundry, Fridays at midnight, CFRC 101.9 FM KSC, you're right, bye.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Hello, and welcome to CFRC 101.9 FM. This is Absolutely Frivolous. Welcome to the show. We're all about comedy here at Absolutely Frivolous. Every week we put on a variety of things, funny stand-up, funny songs, poetry, interviews, whatever we can get that might be funny. We try to put it on the air for you. We have a great show for you today. I hope you'll stay tuned, and I hope that you will stick around for the whole show.
Andrew Stuart McLean, born 19th of April 1948 in Montreal West in Quebec, is a Canadian radio broadcaster, a humorist, and an author, best known as the host of the CBC radio program The Vinyl Cafe. He is often described as a storytelling comic, though he has written many serious stories. Stuart McLean was educated at Lower Canada College in Montreal and graduated from Sir George Williams University with a BA degree in 1971. From 78 to 82, he made documentaries for the radio program Sunday Morning for CBC Radio, and from 1982 until 84, he acted as the show's executive producer. During the 80s and 90s, he was a frequent guest and sometimes host of Morningside with Peter Zowski. As a summer replacement show, Stuart McLean created a radio program called The Vinyl Cafe in 1994. By autumn of 1997, the show was broadcast every Sunday at noon. McLean's books of stories from The Vinyl Cafe have won the Stephen Leacock Memorial Medal for Humor 3 times. Stuart McLean retired in 2004 as a professor at the School of Journalism at Ryerson University in Toronto. And since 1998, Stewart has taken the Vinyl Cafe on the road to theaters across Canada. The Vinyl Cafe is broadcast every weekend on CBC Radio and is also heard via satellite radio around the world and on public radio stations in the U.S., as well as on the web as a weekly podcast. Here's Stewart McLean, and this is Absolutely Frivolous on 101.9 FM.
On Friday morning, while he was shaving, Dave was surprised to see a blemish on his cheek. A small red dot had appeared on his face overnight. He didn't pay it any attention at first, but as he was leaving the house, he thought about it once again, and he went back to the bathroom to check. A pimple? He hadn't had a pimple in years. He got to the front door again and was about to pull it shut behind him when the thought crashed down on him. He was 46 years old. 46-year-olds didn't get pimples. They got skin cancer. He was back in the house in a flash. He found Morley's magnifying makeup mirror. Was that how it happened? You woke up one morning and you had skin cancer? What else could it be? Dave couldn't get the blemish out of his mind. He checked it three times before lunch. He thought about phoning Dr. Freeberg and having her look at it, but what if it was a pimple? He didn't want to risk sitting in his doctor's office and hearing her tell him that. He wished Morley was home so that he could show her, but Morley had taken the kids away for the weekend. Like many men, Dave has a complicated relationship with his body. He inhabits his body the way a nervous traveler settles into a commercial airliner. Carefully monitoring every arrhythmia, continually aware that only through a force of his will does he stay in the air. When Dave and Morley got married, Dave's friend Dorothy suggested the minister change the marriage vow for Dave's turn, change it from in sickness and in health to in sickness and remission. Very funny, said Dave. He couldn't help what his mind did with a list of symptoms. The cancer, as he had come to think of it, preyed on his mind all day. By closing time, he decided to treat it symptomatically, like a pimple. Even if it wasn't better by the time Morley got back, he'd go to the doctor. He wasn't going to show it to Morley. She wouldn't take it seriously. Instead, he thought about asking Debbie Anderson about it. Debbie is the girl who came in on Wednesday and Friday nights and had, since he hired her, been his favorite part-timer. She had short blonde hair, an elfish smile, big brown eyes. She went to the University of Toronto. She wanted to be a phys ed teacher. Do you think this is skin cancer? Said Dave in the middle of the afternoon to Debbie Anderson. Debbie looked at Dave and then at the spot on his face, and then she laughed and said, "Oh, yeah. All the skin cancers I've seen started out just like that." At closing time, Dave went to the drugstore and picked up a tube of Clearasil. He headed toward the cash register, and as he did, he looked around to see if he knew anyone in line. He felt like he was buying a pack of condoms, and he wanted to do it privately. He walked around the store to make sure he was safe. His heart froze when he saw the blood pressure chair. It was in the corner at the back of the store. Now, over the years, Dave has had his blood pressure tested on a number of occasions. Dr. Freeberg had always reported a more or less normal reading. But Dave suspected that these normal readings were not an accurate reflection of reality. They were always taken after he'd been left in the waiting room for 20 or 30 minutes. Why shouldn't he be relaxed? He suspected that the normal readings were, in all likelihood, abnormal. Sometimes when he was upset, he felt his blood pounding in his ears. Surely that wasn't normal. He decided his blood pressure was variable and dependent on stimuli beyond his control. He had never had an opportunity to check his theory. That's why the chair terrified him. It was one thing to suspect you had high blood pressure. It was another thing to know it. Dave didn't want his body to know its own blood pressure. He suspected that if his body knew how close it was to making the leap from borderline to hypertense, it would abandon everything else, all the various viruses and bacteria, and launch a frontal assault on his circulatory system. The blood pressure chair looked like a self-service electric chair. There was a slot on the armrest to slip your arm through and a cuff that presumably inflated when you started the machine. Dave was aware that if he sat down and surrendered his arm to the machine, horrible things could happen. Someone who knew him could waltz in as the machine was printing a score. The idea of Dorothy from the bookstore knowing that his diastolic blood pressure was north of 180 horrified Dave. Horrified him more than the implications of the information itself. He knew it didn't make sense, but he felt if no one, including him and his doctor, knew what his blood pressure was, then it didn't count. It was like cheating on a diet. There was a stack of instruction pamphlets besides the machine. Dave slipped one into his pocket. He didn't read it until he was out on the street. And it opened a whole new realm of possibilities, including step-by-step instructions of what he should do if his reading was 0/0. Something even Dave hadn't imagined. He went out to supper, and then instead of going home, he went back to the drugstore and he cruised by the chair the way he had cruised by Rennie Atwater's house when he was a teenage boy and he was hopelessly in love. He felt just the same, oppressed, anxious, hopeful, hopeless. Just thinking about the chair raised his blood pressure. He knew he was doomed. And he also knew that he'd have to try it when there was no possibility of anyone seeing him. He decided that the early morning would be best. The drugstore opened at 9. 2 days later, Dave showed up at 10 minutes before opening time. He waited on the far side of the street. He felt like a bank robber. When they unlocked the doors, he was the first person in the store, and it didn't take him more than a minute to do the test, he figured. He could be in and gone before anyone saw him. So he went right to the chair and rolled up his sleeve and sat down and put his arm through the metal slot and he pushed the large green button that said Begin Test. He felt the rubber cuff inflate and tighten around his forearm. He felt his heart pounding. And then he felt an excruciating pain run down his arm. Jesus, he was having a heart attack. The machine was squeezing him tighter than he thought it should. Surely it shouldn't feel like this. Surely it shouldn't hurt. He tried to pull his arm out of the cuff. It wouldn't come. He pulled again. Still it wouldn't budge. He looked at the black screen. It was like the screen of a bank machine. It began flashing his score in bright red numbers, 130/75. Not bad. Better than he thought. Well within normal limits. Okay, thought Dave, now let me go. But it didn't. It wouldn't. Dave felt panic surge through him. He was trapped in the chair. He pulled again, more recklessly this time. Still nothing. He looked at the screen. His blood pressure had risen to 135/78. He tried to relax. Then he jerked his arm violently, still nothing. Now his blood pressure was 140/80. Borderline hypertense. Oh God, he thought, this is crazy. He tried to calm himself down again. He sat for a full minute without moving, just following his breath in and out. Something had happened to the machine. The rubber cuff wouldn't deflate, and until it deflated, the metal slot which was holding his arm in the chair would not release him. He opened his eyes. Maybe there's a button I'm supposed to push, he thought. Maybe there's a release button somewhere. He couldn't see a release button. He pulled his arm again, still nothing. He didn't know what to do. He was getting claustrophobic. Collect your thoughts, Dave. What's the worst thing that could happen? Somebody could see him. Somebody he knew could see him there. No. No, the store could catch fire. And he sat there wondering if he could stand up and hump his way out of the store. with a chair attached to him. He imagined getting as far as the checkout counter and then getting wedged in the aisle by the cash register. He thought of dying of smoke inhalation by the cash register with a blood pressure chair attached to his back. The chair strapped to him like a tortoiseshell. It was the kind of trivial death that Dave's always feared. Like being hit by a diaper truck. The kind of death where his friends would gather quietly in some solemn funeral parlor until someone started to giggle. Dave didn't want people giggling at his funeral. He wanted a death with dignity. He began to struggle so violently that the chair started rocking. He heard a man's voice say, "What's going on over there?" Dave looked at the screen. The red numbers were blinking like the clock on a broken VCR, except they were ascending. His blood pressure had sailed through borderline and was now firmly entrenched in hypertense. 160 over 93. Dave looked up and saw Bill Turner, the pharmacist, heading toward him. And to his horror, behind Bill, he saw Debbie Anderson. He felt his heart accelerate. He glanced at the screen, 172 over 90. This was a nightmare. He had the blood pressure of a 75-year-old man. He twisted desperately in the chair and reached for the screen with his left hand, trying to cover the blinking red numbers, the way a man caught outside his house with no clothes on might cover his groin. He felt naked, exposed, humiliated. Debbie and Bill Turner arrived at the chair at the same time. "Hi," said Dave, smiling weakly, still trying to cover the screen. "I'm stuck," said Dave. "My arm. I can't get my arm out." Bill was staring at Dave as if he had asked him for spare change. "See," he said, rattling his arm, "it won't come out." He could feel the blood pounding in his ears. He felt like he was going to faint. "I'm not going to faint," he said to himself. "Hi, Dave," said Debbie cheerfully. And then she said, "Your nose is bleeding." Dave's left hand involuntarily flew away from the screen. He brought it up to his face, and when he took it away, he saw blood on his fingers. And then everyone turned simultaneously from his red hand to the red numbers blinking on the now uncovered screen. The numbers reminded Dave of the digital displays they have in modern elevators. Sadly, the elevator was going up. The three of them watched the screen blink from 172 up to and through 180. It settled at 181. "Geez, Dave," said Bill Turner, "are you okay?" "I can't get my arm out," said Dave for the third time. Dave felt a drop of blood land in his lap. "I'll get you some Kleenex," said Debbie. The fire department arrived 45 minutes later. By then, Dave's blood pressure had settled at 178 over 95. "Geez," said the fire chief, looking at the screen, "are you okay?" The drugstore had taken on the festive feel of an accident scene. There were about 15 people standing in a circle around the chair. Every few minutes, someone new arrived, and there was a blush of whispering as they asked what was going on. After 20 more minutes of fiddling with the chair, the chief sent a man out to the truck to get the jaws of life. They were going to cut Dave out. "Wait a minute," said Bill Turner. "You're going to wreck the chair." "For God's sake, Bill," said Dave, "I'll pay for the chair. Just get me out of here." It took them 5 minutes. Everyone applauded when Dave stood up. He rubbed his arm carefully and said he was fine, and he looked at his watch and said he had to go. People slapped him on the back as he pushed through the crowd, as if he had won a race or something. Debbie Anderson handed him another Kleenex and said, "I'll see you Wednesday." The red blemish on his face disappeared a week afterwards. He never mentioned it to Morley. Thank you.
This is Sean Kelly, Chris Bound, and Sarah Harmer saying, see,
see. You're listening to 101.9
in Kingston.
Well, that's about it for me today. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Come back every Wednesday at 5 o'clock. We'll play a variety of different things, different comedy, different songs, different stand-up, whatever we can find. You can listen to us, of course, on the radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, or you can listen to us on the web. We are on cfrc.ca, and you can check out past shows on our archives page as well on the web. Have a great week. Please keep listening to CFRC. And here's Henry Rollins on 101.9 FM.
The thing that that we've all been through, because we're all working too hard, is exhaustion mixed with travel. I am usually exposed in airports in this incredibly maudlin state of exhaustion. And when I get no sleep, I get maudlin. My emotions like wham, wham. And I'll be there with the headphones on, listening to music that I normally like, okay, this is cool, Al Green, yeah, Smokey Robinson. But when you haven't slept in a day and a half, I will always love you. And so I usually will board an airplane going some long distance when in this state. And one time I went from Los Angeles to Australia. What happens to me is I go without sleep the night before the flight. I get on the flight, they sit you down, they strap you in, and they start giving you coffee. Really bad idea. First off, they give you a bunch of peanuts. So you get a big, you know, dose of protein, and then they start giving you caffeine. Caffeine and protein, and you are strapped into a chair for the next 12 hours. Okay, there's some of us who have a little bit too much energy as it is. You give us some protein and some caffeine, they need to, like, put me in restraint. So I'm like, the movie starts. Okay, a no sleep and 18 cups of coffee. If they throw the slightest bone to me of emotional display, I go with it. And I was watching White Squall one time. And so, basically, it's like Dead Poets Society on the water. Young men coming of age, a lot of virgins on board, a lot of mommy and daddy damage. And at the end of the movie, a huge wave comes out of nowhere, a phenomenon in the ocean called a white squall. And it just comes down on this boat like a Buick dropping on a five-year-old. And it fucks the boat up. And now the boat is sinking. It's sinking. And the captain is trying to rescue his wife, who is in the hold, and she cannot get out. And there's a glass, you know, porthole. He's looking down. She's been knocked out cold. She wakes up, and she's looking up at him like, "What's going on? You'll save me." And he's looking down, and he cannot get to her. And the boat is sinking. He's going to lose his woman. And she's looking up at him like, "What? Save me." And he can't. And he's crying. He's hitting the thing. And you know, man, if you've ever loved a woman, if you've ever loved a guy, and you think of how much you love that person, if they went out like that, seriously, what would you do? You'd ruin your life. You'd rip your head off trying to get over that kind of grief. So even like when you're well rested, 3 square meals in 8 hours, you watch that and go, "Whoa, man, that's harsh." Okay, on no sleep and a lot of coffee. Oh God! Oh my God! Like a projectile tearing. I grab the guy next to me. Hold me. And the people walk by me, my God, he's been laughing half the flight, now he's crying. "Would you like some more coffee?" "No, yes, okay." Anyway, months go by, and it's Thanksgiving time. And my manager throws a Thanksgiving dinner. And so that means free food, and if I can get into his bathrooms, free toilet paper, free office supplies. I'm stealing liquid paper, pens, utensils, food, you know, and I'm going in with the army surplus pants, because you can load the side pockets like the cheeks of a squirrel, man. And so I go into his place like, hey, yeah, happy Thanksgiving, yeah, whatever, you know, pumpkin pie. Fork and cool fork. Okay. Yeah, I'd like half that turkey. Into the bathroom, like 800 yards of toilet paper, it'll last me 3 weeks, cool? And I'm just like, I am loaded. I can live a week and a half off all this stuff. I've got scotch tape. I'm stealing stuff left and right. And so from the waist down, it's all 2 to 4-year-olds running amok, as they are wont to do. And you know how violent kids are at that age, where if I need your toy, I come over and hit you in the side of your head with a fist. I don't go, hi, can I play? You say, ah! Blood-curdling scream, toy drops. Other person grabs it, runs away, and holds it. So from the waist down, there's like little coups, revolutions, deceit, betrayal, and they're all in diapers. So below me is bedlam. And so manager goes, hey, Henry, I'd like you to meet someone. She lives up the road from us. She's a neighbor. I'm like, okay, that's cool. And, you know, her little kid's running around. And he goes, this is blah, 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 the name of this wonderful woman. I forget. I'm like, oh, how do you do? I recognize you. She goes, okay. I go, you are the White Squaw lady. And she's like, oh, yes, I was in White Squaw. I go, oh, man, when you died, I was like crazy with grief, man. I was crying. I was like, man. And she's like, oh, well thank you so much. And she's looking at this guy with his pants bulging with like stolen stuff, you know, food, a slice of pie sticking out of my ass. Haven't shaved, you know, tattoos, thick neck, you know, punting kids out of my way, you know. And I'm going, I'm really into you, man. You made me cry. You made me feel something. Man, I want to chop off one of my hands and give it to you as a tribute. It's a tribute! And she went like... And I never saw her again. But she's a nice lady. So, yeah, exhaustion. Anyway...
Stock markets are in turmoil following yesterday's announcement from Butterflies and Emery Board that the proposed toenail is down by the seashore. Witches and minivans continue to frolic under intense chocolate pudding.
If you don't know how to react to what was just said, then you can begin to understand what it feels like to live with Alzheimer's disease. Tasks like making sense of what you hear can become impossible. Alzheimer's disease takes everything that makes you who you are and can begin in your early 40s. Please donate now to help find a cure at alzheimer.ca. Alzheimer's. Forget everything you knew.
This is Bob Duthie, station volunteer from 1958 to 1959. You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
Look out the left, the captain said. See down there, that's where we're gonna land. Just mythical. Oh, there's a heaven down there.